In 1967, Carl Amalantis was a Rhodes Scholar opposed to the war in Vietnam. But he was also a Marine, and he decided he could no longer sit in a classroom while men he'd been in boot camp with were serving. So he went to Vietnam. He saw a lot of combat, and when he came home, like many veterans, he kept the trauma to himself. Then writing became a form of therapy. In 2010, Carl Amalantis published Matterhorn, his best-selling novel about the Vietnam War. And last year, he wrote a nonfiction book called What It Is Like to Go to War, now out in paperback. It's about the consequences of combat and coming home. Last fall, Carl Amalantis spoke to Here Now's Alex Ashlock, and we want to caution that some listeners might find the content of their conversation disturbing.
Were you prepared for combat?
Technically, the Marine Corps does an incredible job of preparing Marines for combat, and as do the other services. But no, not in terms of this basic fact. If you're not a sociopath, you've been raised that it's bad to kill people. And then all of a sudden, it's good to kill people. And then it was bad to kill people. And it's an extreme adjustment. And dealing with that is something that nobody really ever talked to me about in terms of the effects, I guess the right word to use is on the soul. No matter what your religious stance is, there is a part of us that is deeper than just our thinking, and it's connected to the whole universe in some way, and that's what gets damaged when you kill other people. And yet, I'm not a pacifist. I'm a very proud Marine. I'm proud of my service, and I'm proud of the Marine Corps today and all of the military. But I do think that we could do a better job. And I'm not laying the finger on the military. I don't think it's really their job because, I mean, you know, I was talking to a Marine, active duty Marine. He says, we're trying everything we can before these guys go out to try and figure out how to transition them. But we're Marines. We're not psychologists. And I went, yeah, I mean, they're not. See, I mean, they're there to do something else and they're trying. But it's when it's our culture that has to start to learn to accept these veterans back. And a lot of the alienation is a result of I think, our civilian attitude about who really is fighting the war. Ancient cultures, everybody in the village went out and fought the war. So there was no sense of, well, we didn't do it. You guys did it. No, the whole village did it. And because of technological advancement, size, complexity, we don't do it that way anymore. So then again, it calls for a more consciousness on our part about really who is involved in this. Well, it's all of us.
And you also write in the book about a consciousness that you think may be missing actually in combat. What happens before, what happens after a combat mission, after an assault, that there should be time for reflection on the battlefield.
You're in a state when you kill another human being that you don't really believe that that is a human being. Now, you know, these words that are politically incorrect, you know, gook, slope, towelhead, ragtop, all those, it's gone on for, you know, millennium. And the reason for that is because you're raised not to kill people. So what you do, I call it pseudo-speciating, you actually kind of pull a psychological trick on yourself and say, well, this is just an animal out here trying to hurt my friends and trying to kill me. That makes it possible. All right. But if you continue to do that, after a while, it becomes ingrained. And then you begin to see the enemy as animals all the time. And that can lead to atrocities. That can lead to doing violence in excess of what it would take to get the mission accomplished. And so there's no way that you're going to get some 19-year-old to consciously say, oh, well, I'm not going to pseudo-speciate. I mean, come on. I mean, it's just not going to work. And especially young guys. That's why they're such great warriors. They are unreflective, and they happen to be full of testosterone and in great shape. I mean, that's what you want. But if I'd have had time to reflect that we did lose our friends, and we want to mourn them, and we did have friends maimed, and we want to mourn that, and we did kill other people who, but for the grace of God, were born in some North Vietnamese village or some Taliban-dominated village instead of some little town in Oklahoma. It's just sort of a destiny issue that we have no control over. And so pulling back as soon as possible will, I think, aid the healing process and the reintegration process because it brings it to consciousness sooner. As opposed to in my case, I think I was probably in my 40s before these. I had an experience where this pseudo-speciation that broke down. I actually had to look a North Vietnamese kid in the eye because he was trying to. He had a hand grenade in his hands, and I remember saying, "If you don't throw it, if you don't throw it, I won't pull the trigger." But of course, I couldn't speak Vietnamese, and he threw the hand grenade at me. But it was at that moment that it broke down, and I remembered his eyes. This is a kid just like me. 20 years later, those eyes start popping up late at night when I'm driving down the road, and they pop up in dreams. Well, that was my unconscious trying to say, deal with this. Well, if I'd have dealt with it, you know, when we were safe again and had finished up the battle, it would have come sooner, and I think that my own reintegration would have come sooner. So that's what I'm after a little bit.
Is it something as simple as burying the dead and saying a word over them from the other side after a battle?
Absolutely. It is just that simple. And I do remember, you know, when we'd be in a fierce battle, of course, we'd pack our dead guys out in body bags, but we would throw the NVA soldiers down into, you know, the canyon underneath where we were fighting and just pile them up down there. And again, that's that thing, well, they're not people. And I had one occasion where a couple of kids in my unit, and you have to remember they're like high school kids, cut off the ears of some of the dead NVA soldiers who had just killed their friends, by the way. And I saw them with these ears, and I just went, you guys, come on, you can't do this. And I'm not the type of person that, you know, would come down on them with both feet, because, I mean, we'd been fighting for 7-6 days. I mean, we were exhausted. I mean, you have to sort of understand their mentality. And I said, okay, so to punish them, I said, you're going to go bury those bodies. When they started burying the bodies, they started to cry. And I went, huh, no kidding, that touched them in some way. So that's where that idea came from.
You've said a lot of the things you might say, I think, in answer to this final question, but what would you like readers to take away from reading your book?
I would like them to understand that the kid that went to war is not the one that came home, and there has to be a concerted effort to try and do better on these more psycho-spiritual aspects of combat than we have done heretofore. If we could make progress there, then I feel quite satisfied that it was a book worth writing.
Carl Marlantis's latest book is What It Is Like to Go to War. He spoke with Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. You're listening to Here and Now.